We've been going through over the course of the last several weeks the idea of in our apologetics course, defending the creation story, and in that, dispelling the lies of evolution. And so tonight, what we're going to look at is we're going to look at the topic of natural selection, and we're going to kind of introduce it as a topic, and then we're going to go through, and I'm going to give you four different categories in which we can refute natural selection as it is sold to us by evolutionists, and it has been for the last 200 years. And so if you follow along, I'm going to try to do this in a timely fashion. If you need to move to be able to see the PowerPoints, we are going to try to move through those in a timely fashion as well. But if you can see them, fine. And if you don't care to see them and you're more of an audio learner versus visual learner, that's great as well. So we're going to go to the Lord in prayer here before we get started, and then we're going to get into this topic of refuting natural selection. Dear Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for your many, many blessings. For the folks that are here, Lord, I think of tonight, Brother Mike and Brother Zach that are on their way here still from work. Lord, keep them safe. Keep them safe on the roads as they make their way here. I pray for those that are ill. I think of Tony, really not feeling well right now, and the whole Cottrell family, they're taking care of her. I think of Rusty Gates, Miss Martha Overdorf, and others. Please be with them, heal them up, and give them strength. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. So the topic of natural selection, Charles Darwin, natural selection was the main mechanism of evolution. So it makes sense that we would start with really what is the core of the philosophy or the theory or what we've called the gospel of evolution. And natural selection right here is actually part of, usually we say, The Origin of Species. The full title of his book in 1859 was The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, or the Preservation of the Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. And so natural selection was right at the core of this from the beginning. And as you look at it, Darwin referred to us as the survival of the fittest. The survival of the fittest. The weak die and the fittest survive. I mentioned, I believe, a couple weeks ago when we talked about this last, this actually led into, less than a century later, some pretty genocidal attributes based off of evolution, where it says we are the fittest, so we should survive and kill those we determine are the weakest. And there's a lot of philosophies that stem from this natural selection and survival of the fittest idea, those being eugenics and kind of a cleansing of the human race, which is ungodly. God loves every single soul that is born, whether they have mental handicaps or whatever race they are. But obviously an evolutionist wouldn't believe in God and wouldn't care about those things. Darwin believed that there are too many creatures for the environment, believed that we were an overpopulated planet. Sounds familiar. We hear a lot of our elites today, like Bill Gates, saying that there's too many people, that we're overpopulated, and because of this, we must always struggle to be the ones to survive. Because of the struggle, only the best adapted creatures survive. It might be birds with larger beaks, or moths with better camouflage, or giraffes with longer necks. And then they teach that over millions of years, this process of natural selection then gives us the species that we have today, and it gives us the evolution of creatures. Darwin described natural selection as follows. He said, these individuals with the best genetic fitness for the environment will produce offspring that can more successfully compete in that environment. Thus, the subsequent generation will have a higher representation of this offspring, and the population will have evolved. What they say is if a dog is fast and survives because they're fast, then that dog's offspring will be fast, which actually isn't scientifically true. There are some attributes that would be similar, like most folks who are tall have tall children. But there's a lot of tall folks in my family, and I'm definitely not tall. And so there's a lot of, Brother Terry's laughing, he said, try being me. But this is how he taught it. This is how he taught that that evolution occurred, is through this idea of natural selection. And on this trip to the Galapagos Islands, he traveled around these islands and he observed a specific animal, and that was a finch. It's a type of a bird. And these finches were all throughout the island, and there was different types. There were some finches that had great big beaks, and there were some finches that had very small beaks. There were different colors, etc. And Darwin observed these changes and differences in these birds. He found an example that the Galapagos Islands had a drought. And because of that, there was a shortage of small, easy to eat seeds, so that they were forced to eat larger, tougher seeds. So birds with larger beaks would survive better in this situation, because those larger beaks could break down and eat those larger seeds. And the birds with larger beaks became the majority, because if birds with smaller beaks can't eat, they die. Well, he says, because of that, obviously, through natural selection, this happened. Obvious. I mean, those dots are so close together, you have to connect them. Of course not, and we're going to talk about that. But he believed that small changes over long periods of time, over very long periods of time, millions of years, small changes will take us from a monkey to humans. Now you say, those dots are easy to connect, Brother Foster thinks, while taking care of his two boys while his wife's away. But scientifically, looking at it scientifically, it's just a huge leap. It's beyond a huge leap. But this is what they taught and still do teach. Darwin emphasized the word natural. He rejected any idea of design from intelligence that was outside. He said everything came from nature. That nature has evolved itself into what we see today. And that there is no intelligent being that imposed its will upon what we see today. And created and designed everything we see. We're going to see how, without an intelligent being, God, nothing that we see around us, none of those processes would even exist. His objective was to prove that there was a mechanism to provide and to change and to give life, a way to explain away the life that we see other than God. We spoke about a couple weeks ago that this idea was radical in his day and age. In the 1800s, this idea was fringe. The majority, the stark majority of individuals believed that God created the world in six literal 24-hour days, as the Bible states, as we believe, as now that science has shown more observable evidence, we can actually be more sure of. But he wanted to have a way to explain it other than God, and natural selection is therefore a blind process. There's no intelligence, no designer. There's just dots that you connect. Why? Because some scientists say those are connected. Richard Dawkins, he said, the natural selection is blind, unconscious process which Darwin discovered. Blind, unconscious process. That's how everything came to be. He continued to say, we live in a universe which has no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. The more you read from this guy, the more depressing his life sounds. But then again, a life without Christ is very bleak. George Simpson says, a man is the result of a purposeless process. The natural selection and the teaching of this, literally what they're saying is we as humans were an accident. There's no purpose for us to be here. There's no reason we were put here. Now we can look at the Bible and we can say, hey, he formed us with his hands. He breathed into us the breath of life. He put each and every one of us here on earth with a unique purpose. There's a different purpose in my life than in Chase's life. And Terry's life and Reggie's life. God has us here for a very unique purpose, but that not not when it comes to evolutionists. They believe that there's a purposelessness to it. Another one, Stephen Jay Gould, said human beings arose as an accident. These are some of the top quoted, quote-unquote, scientists that you can find in about every textbook and about every biology class in high school and college and now even in elementary classes across our country. I want to look at natural selection, and we're going to look at four specific, and I want to list them here, four specific things that we want to kind of refute and pull apart that natural selection does not hold up. First of all, natural selection can only explain minor variation. Natural selection can only explain very minor variations. As he observed with those finches there in the Galapagos Islands, yes, the ones who could not eat the food that was available died. That is, though, a minor variation to say that the ones with the bigger beaks survived. Because guess what? They're still finches. They didn't become a dinosaur. The second thing we're going to look at is that natural selection can only select, it cannot build. The idea of natural selection being the engine and the mechanism by which we get evolution does not make sense because it's selecting from something that already exists. It doesn't create or build something new. Thirdly, natural selection cannot see the future or work toward a goal. So it would not select something that would not be helpful for the creature's immediate survival, which we'll look at. I don't want to belabor that point. And then fourthly, we're going to look at the fact that natural selection requires competition. For survival of the fittest, there has to be competition. But nature shows more symbiosis than fighting. So starting with number one, natural selection can only explain very minor variations. Evolutionists have never proven that natural selection is a mechanism for the evolution of creatures. They just state it. They state it as fact. They state it boldly as fact. It's like when you turn on the news today, you can hear people, news pundits, that will state things as fact that are blatantly untrue, and they just know that there's enough people that if they state it very strongly, if they say it forcefully, even if it's a bold-faced lie, people will believe it. But we're going to look at the fact that it doesn't hold up. Darwin's book was titled On the Origin of Species, but he did not give any evidence, for how those species originated. You can look cover to cover. How did those species originate? One of the greatest questions when having conversation with an evolutionist, one of the greatest questions you can ask is, and where did that come from? And what's the next question you ask? And where did that come from? Because you can look cover to cover and it doesn't give you an origin at all. It makes up a lot of supposed scientific ideas and theories, but he only gave evidence of small changes, but zero origin. Like I stated, the finch is still a finch. Consider the example of the apple maggot. You say, what a lovely topic, maggots. And the apple maggot, it's in the talked about with the British Natural History Museum. And they speak here, and I'm going to read from them, and I want to then dissect. So these are obviously evolutionists talking here, and it says, one example of evolution, this is the great example of evolution, is the apple maggot. Apple maggots eat apples. But that has not always been true. They used to feed on a plant called hawthorn and were called hawthorn maggots. But in the 1700s, when apples were introduced in North America, some hawthorn maggots started to feed on apples. Nearly identical as adult flies, the apple maggots evolved from hawthorn maggots, proving evolution. The shift in diet separated the maggots into two groups, is what they state. The fact is, the apple maggot is still a maggot. It still produces the same kind of fly as a hawthorn maggot. The only thing that changed is its diet. It's like saying that myself, as a carnivore, I like eating steak, fried chicken, and cheeseburgers. But if somebody decided to change their diet, you might see some outward changes. If they start trying to change their diet and become a vegetarian, they'd look a little more malnourished and the hair might turn blue and other things, but other than that, they'd still be a human being. Nothing changed except they had poor choice in their diet. Just because the maggots started eating apples because the apples were there, usually I eat whatever snack is available. And if there's not one available, I go find one. And if it's an apple, it's an apple. It doesn't make me a different creature. I didn't evolve when I picked up an apple for the first time. These people claiming to be so brilliant, these scientists at the Natural History Museum of London, I mean, that's the best they got. Well, it doesn't get better from there. This so-called evidence is produced by one of the world's most premier natural history museums, demonstrates their bankruptcy of this theory. But then consider the bird evolution as an example of what would be required if evolution were true. They teach that, according to evolution, a small dinosaur here then becomes, over millions and millions of years, becomes a bird like we see flying around all around us. Well, what kind of changes in quote-unquote natural selection of evolution would be necessary to complete this process? Well, first of all, a heavy earthbound body would have to evolve into a lightweight aerodynamic one. Then solid bones would have to evolve into hollow, lightweight bones that are light but strong, that actually have a different makeup. They're made of different things than a dinosaur's bones were. Scales on a dinosaur would have to evolve into complex flight feathers. How long did it take humans just to figure out how to fly in an airplane? And these feathers are perfectly placed to be able to fly. Bellow-like lungs in a dinosaur would have to evolve into an avian sac-like lungs in a bird. A land-bound reptile would have to evolve an avian brain capable of thriving in completely different environments. And the dinosaur would have to evolve the ability to sing pretty songs. You ask any little child, even my daughter, who can't completely speak yet, what does a dinosaur say? And she'll say, "Roar!" And what does a bird say? "Tweet, tweet." Dinosaur would have to evolve the ability to migrate thousands of miles annually and know exactly where to go. Natural selection cannot explain any of these miraculous changes. It can only explain variations within a species. None of that, see, that's a lot of assuming. They'll draw a nice little, remember that first thing I had up there where it had a dinosaur, then it had a dinosaur with little feathers sticking out, then it had a dinosaur with arms that had wings sticking out of its arm. Man, they can make nice little drawings. But when you say, where's the evidence? It's not just that there's not a lot. There's zero. Absolutely none. If they make these assumptions that by natural selection, they just like the finches needed bigger beaks. Well, different bone structure, whole different lung system, different makeup bodily, scales turning to feathers, all of this. These are drastic changes. Natural selection can only be attributed to minor, small changes within a species. And we've seen adaptations. All it takes is for you to go down to a pet store. Everything is a doodle today. There's a Labradoodle, and there's a German doodle, and there's a this doodle, and there's a that doodle. There's everything doodled. Guess what? Sometimes it doesn't look like it, but it's still a dog. It's still a dog. And there's changes, and there's differences. And what they say is, what's great about when you cross it with a doodle is that it becomes hyperallergenic. You got no hair. I think it's the only way I'd get my wife convinced to have a dog. No hair. Those that are allergic to dogs can have those kind of dogs. Great. It's still a dog. It's still a dog. So natural selection can only explain minor variations. Natural selection can only select. It cannot build. Natural selection cannot produce new creatures because it has no creative power to add information to the creature's DNA. When those finches with larger beaks were compared to those finches with smaller beaks, their DNA would still be finches. Evolution cannot and has not once been proven to add or subtract DNA into any creature. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. When Charles Darwin wrote The Origin of the Species, he did not know anything about DNA because it wasn't discovered yet. So he had the benefit of selling many, many, many copies of his book without the evidence, as much evidence to disprove it. Most of our knowledge about DNA came only in the last 50 years. It's why cases from 70, 80 years ago are being able to be solved in the criminal justice system because of DNA evidence. In 1962, James Watson and Francis Crick were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for the discovery of the shape and structure of DNA. When I was in chemistry class in high school, we had to make a model of DNA with colored marshmallows and noodles. It took me longer than it should have taken to put it together. This is a model of the DNA in the Science Museum in London. DNA is so small that it takes a very expensive electron microscope to even see it. Microscope in your science high school lab is not going to be able to see DNA at all. So they have these machines where they can break down, and a strand of DNA under this microscope looks like this. An ant under a microscope looks like that. A flea in a microscope, that same microscope, looks like this, guitar string, etc. But each living cell has a copy of this DNA. Every single cell that makes up your body has this DNA in it. The exact same DNA. The DNA that is drastically different than mine is your DNA. It's why they can make sure, like if I were to touch something, just the simple cells, skin cells that would come off by rubbing up against something could be found, could be tested under a strong microscope, and they could match that against other DNA cells of mine and see that the DNA matched, because my DNA is going to look different than yours. But the most complex of complex of complex things, breaking it down to a cellular level, then in the nucleus of the cell, breaking it down to a chromosome of DNA. These are cells under a powerful microscope, and humans have 10 to 100 trillion cells. Obviously, it's based on the size of the human. That is 10 or 100 followed by 12 zeros. It's a lot of cells, and each and every one of those perfectly, by design, by our Creator, has a copy of your DNA. The body forms about 300 billion new cells every day. That's 200 million cells per minute. Your body produces 200 million new cells per minute. You say, Pastor, I basically replaced my whole body just sitting here. You talk so long. But it's all a system by design. It's all by design. For example, your skin is continually being replaced with plump new cells. Each cell has the exact right shape and structure for its function. So cells that make up the organs inside of your body could not be used as cells to make up your skin. It wouldn't work. What I'm saying is natural selection would mean we have to develop a lot of these things by accident. So all of a sudden, the cells that don't belong places start popping up. Well, what would happen is those cells would actually be attacked and be killed. When there's a wound in the skin, cell formation speeds up. It gets real fast. You can't see it very much anymore. My son has got this fascination with grabbing my face. So he'll come up and he'll grab my nose or grab my, and he'll scratch me. But real quickly, my body started to replace those cells faster than usual to fill the gap, and then it slows back down to normal. Each cell is more complicated than an entire modern city. These modern landscapes, I don't know if many of you have been to some of these modern cities. You go to New York, or I don't know if we can still call Chicago a modern city. Some of these other cities I've been to, I think the biggest city I've ever been to was Seoul, Korea. And 30 plus million people. I mean, it was just, it just seemed like you couldn't see the city in one look. It was huge. Well, our single cell, remember trillions of them, hundred trillion of them, a single cell is more complicated than an entire city. In fact, a single living cell is similar to a city. It has a command center, and it has gates to come in, and roadways and cargo carriers down here, and it has power transmission lines where the proteins power may move through, and waste disposal and factories, and guess what? There's probably much more that we just don't even know about yet. The DNA in one cell holds enough information equivalent of 1,000 large books. You say, I have not read 1,000 books in my life. How about every cell in your body? Every cell. The DNA in a single cell holds enough information for 1,000 large books. DNA is like a blueprint that contains instructions for constructing a building. It has all of the information that it needs to build new cells, to function as it ought to keep you alive. DNA is like the instructions for making a doily. I saw this, and it gives me a headache. Everyone knows it didn't make itself. It must have a designer or maker. My grandmother used to make these. I didn't always get the purpose of them. I still don't fully get the purpose of them and don't necessarily like them. But it amazes me that somebody had the patience, and it never dawned on me that it happened by accident, that her ball of thread, her ball of string would just fall in a way where it naturally select itself into a doily. The seamstress reads these instructions. I can read, but I can't read those. Likewise, DNA has the instructions to make the person. The cell reads these instructions and makes various parts of your body. It knows exactly what it ought to do for that part of your body. The DNA has the information for that type of plant or creature, and only that type. Only that type. The microscopic DNA is about 3 feet in length and is coiled up in a miraculous way so that it fits into the nucleus of a tiny cell. You understand that every single one of those 10 to 100 trillion cells has one of these strands of DNA, and they're about 3 feet in length, coiled up perfectly inside of the nucleus, inside of this cell. And the strands of DNA are coiled together and packed into the chromosome packages in breathtaking marvel of microengineering. All of this inside of a living cell. If the DNA of each cell of your body was stretched out, it would reach the sun and back at least 4 times. Just your DNA. Just your DNA. If you were to spread out every strand of one individual's DNA to the sun and back 4 times, and the sun is 93 million miles away. Man's DNA contains the instructions to build every part of his body. There's different DNA for the brain, for the skin, for the lungs, for the kidney, for the stomach, for the intestines. Not only does each cell contain the information to build the body, but it also has machinery to make the body from that information. It has the information and the ability to put forward that process. It does this by building proteins and other things and using those to make up a living body. This DNA information is passed from generation to generation, and it never results in a different creature. Never. In fact, usually, you can see only similarities. Usually, when you see a family lined up, I see a couple of Ewing kids sitting next to their mom and dad, and most people can look at Tavian and say, and his dad, and say, yeah, I can see it. They're related, clearly. And except for your dad's young enough, he doesn't have glasses. So there's variations. There's variations. There's some aspects and attributes of my kids I don't claim. That's obviously my wife's side of the family. But as this DNA is passed down from mom and dad and passed down through the generations, it has never resulted in a different type of creature. The Bible made that clear in the beginning of Genesis that mankind, animals, and plants would all reproduce after their same kind. To build something new, such as growing feathers or wings on a dinosaur, would require new information in the DNA. But natural selection has no power to add this new information into the DNA. It just means that if a bird had a bigger beak, it survived. That's not new information in the DNA. It's a new attribute. Some of us have bigger noses than others and can sniff our way to more food more quickly. I being one of those. It was believed in Darwin's day that if a man such as a blacksmith developed strong muscles, he would pass those characteristics down to his son. So that when my dad was had us boys as little youngsters, he used to say, "Do you want to grow up and be big and fat like daddy?" And when I was very young, I used to say, "Yes!" And then I was like, "No, not really. I want to be big, but maybe not fat." But it would mean, once again, that all physical attributes would be passed down. That if the father was a blacksmith and was very strong, then here comes a baby boy who's definitely going to be strong, even if that individual became a typist instead of a blacksmith. We know that's not the case. It's not how things work. This thinking was based on Jean Lemarck's theory that the giraffe got its long necks by stretching higher into the tree branches. That they had eaten up all the green stuff at the bottom of the tree, and there was still food at the top, and they were really, really hungry. So they stretched their necks out long, and voila, giraffes have long necks. But this is now known to be untrue. If a man develops big muscles or strong running legs, he does not pass that characteristic on to his children because these are acquired traits. They don't change the DNA. Stretching muscles doesn't change a creature's DNA. That is inherited from its mother and father. Even if one giraffe developed a slightly longer neck, this trait would not be passed on. An example of this is there is a civilization where it's a custom to stretch one's neck. And they put rings between the collarbone and the jawbone from a very young age, and over a course of time try to stretch the individual's necks. Guess what? Two things are true. Number one, their children were not born automatically with long necks. They had to then put those same bands of gold or other things to stretch their necks. What's also true is while it did stretch a sort, their necks actually didn't become longer. They became stretched out. Their necks were the same length. Their vertebrae sometimes damaged, but they didn't get extra vertebrae. They didn't become giraffes. The same is true with the old Chinese custom of binding one's feet to make a lady's feet small and petite, whereas a young girl, they would bind their feet so they wouldn't grow. All it meant is they had very mangled feet. They didn't have smaller feet. They didn't create natural selection of feet, and their daughters were not automatically born with very small feet. Well, I mean, babies have small feet in general, but they didn't have that attribute of having very small feet by doing that. This trait would not be passed along to its offspring. Friedrich Wiseman disproved this theory with his experiments on mice. He cut off the tails of 901 mice for 19 generations. Some of these scientists just seem cruel. So he had mouse number 899, female, mouse number 900, male, and they would create mouse number 901, baby, cut these tails off, and guess what the baby was born with? A tail. Every single time. Think about Darwin's finches, because of a drought, the finches with larger beaks survived better. But this process didn't create a beak. Those larger beaked finches already existed. It didn't even create larger beaks. The DNA of the finch has information for different sizes of beaks. They're just the ones that survived because their DNA had created a larger beak, which lended itself to being able to process the food that was available for them. That's number two. Natural selection can only select, it cannot build. We looked at number one as natural selection can only explain minor variations. Thirdly, natural selection cannot see the future or work toward a goal so it would not select something that would not be helpful for the creature's immediate survival. That's what Darwin had stated. He says, we may feel sure that any variation in the least degree injurious would be destroyed. So that if there was anything, any variation that did not meet the immediate need, it would be destroyed. This means that partially formed structures, such as a partial wing, would not be preserved. You'd say, that's a mutant. That's messed up. It's going to die. That wing's actually going to get in its way. It's not going to be able to perform as a bird or as a dinosaur well. Evolutionists believe that one creature changed into another creature by small changes happening over millions of years. Evolutionists say that the bird would evolve from a small reptile dinosaur like this. This is a model in the Australian Museum in Sydney. And this dinosaur supposedly began to grow feathers and wings and gradually became a bird. This is how they depict the part of the dinosaur and part bird as it evolved. This is stated as science, but this is a creation of an artist. No one has ever found proof of this. It has feathers and small wings and a beak, but it still would not be able to fly. Models in museums show the part of the bird with two fully formed wings, but evolution would need to start with the dinosaur growing a part of a wing. Even if this could happen, it would be no advantage to the creature. No advantage at all. It'd be no different than some humans are born with a sixth toe or a sixth finger on their hand. It actually becomes oftentimes a problem. In fact, it would cripple the monster like a four-winged fruit fly. According to evolution, this process is blind and cannot see the future or plan toward a goal, so that partial processes would be useless and would be destroyed, according to Darwin. Consider the whale's evolution. Doesn't he look like a whale? Great big whale. Evolutionists say the whale evolved from a wolf-like creature. This is a model from the British Museum of Natural History. Theory of whale evolution here is from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration educational website. That's a mouthful. But it starts with that wolf-like creature and comes all the way down to the great whales that we have today. It looks like a kindergartner had fun with a crayon. But they show a wolf-like creature gradually changing into various other types of creatures and finally becoming a whale. This chart of the Pacific Science Center in Seattle depicts all of the whales descending from a wolf-like creature up here and coming into all of the different types of whales we have today. And this is how National Geographic describes it. The whale's ascendancy to sovereign size apparently began 60 million years ago when hairy four-legged mammals in search of food or sanctuary ventured into the water. As eons passed, changes slowly occurred. These wolves just decided, we're going to go venture into some salt water. Hind legs began to disappear. Front legs changed into flippers, obviously. Hair gave way to a thick, smooth blanket of blubber. Nostrils moved to the top of the head. The tail broadened into flukes. And in the buoyant water world, the body became enormous. Yeah, that's it. I just have spent too much time in salt water. Here's a man standing on an ocean floor near a whale, saying that this came from a wolf. How could this happen? If a wolf started growing a flipper, what would happen to that creature? It would quickly die. Actually, in a wolf pack, they'd probably kill it. Other wolves would kill it. It doesn't work. Natural selection cannot see the future or work towards a goal, so it would not select something that would not be helpful for the creature's immediate survival. Number four, and I'm using my phone over here, so I don't know the time. Actually, I have a watch. We're going to get it done. Natural selection, might have to skip a couple things. Natural selection requires competition for survival of the fittest, but nature shows a more symbiotic relationship than a fighting relationship. It's fascinating, as I was studying for this, the way that I didn't even realize that God created systems in nature, in his creation, to work together. We're not competing in one another, we're actually reliant on one another. Darwin described nature as everything being red in tooth and claw, but this is not true. Though there is tooth and claw in nature since the fall, we do not observe it everywhere, fought struggle for survival via the competition that Darwin's theory demands. The universe is massive, and it's an interrelated system, which is evident from the level of the galaxies to the living cell to the atom. I mean, even if our Earth was only a few miles closer to the sun or a few miles further from the sun, you think our winters or summers are bad now. Life would cease to be able to exist. If our Earth stopped spinning as it is spinning, life would cease to exist. Everything works together. Consider the laws of physics. Charles Townes is a Nobel-winning physicist. He said, "This is a very special universe." I agree. It's remarkable that it came out of just this way. If the laws of physics weren't just the way they are, we wouldn't be here at all. The sun couldn't be there. The laws of gravity and the nuclear laws and magnetic theory, quantum mechanics, and so on have to be just the way they are for us to be here. Paul Davies, in his book, he wrote, "On the face of it, the universe does look as if it had been designed by an intelligent creator expressly for the purpose of the spawning of sentient beings." It's humans. "Like the portage of the tale of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the universe seems to be just right for life." There are interconnections in this symbiotic relationship everywhere. Biologists call them mutualism, environmental community, biosphere, biosystems, ecosystems. There's a lot of names they give to it, but systems ecology in this study of nature is a gigantic system. You take one simple example: that we breathe in air and we absorb oxygen for life. We breathe out carbon dioxide, which then is exactly what plants need for their life. All of the evidence of design and creation, not of natural selection. I'm going to go through a few examples of these symbiotic relationships where it's not a battle of the fittest. It's a design that works for both creatures. Humans and intestinal bacteria. This is actually a picture under a microscope of the bacteria, type of bacteria that is in your intestines right now. Bacteria are not part of the human body. Those are not human cells. Those are separate organisms that are bacterias. But they do things that our body cannot do for itself, which are necessary for our survival. These synthesize vitamins essential for nutrition, such as vitamin K and vitamin B complex vitamins. Friendly bacteria kill harmful bacteria. And there's plenty of harmful bacteria out there. But there's a lot of different examples there, and I thought that was a nice depiction of them just really beating down the bad bacteria. And pathogens. Bacteria synthesize niacin to make NAD, which is necessary for energy conversion of the cell's mitochondria. The human body itself cannot synthesize NAD, but it is essential for life. In order for us to take food and create it into energy, how does food become energy? Well, it's this thing called NAD. Our body does not produce it. These bacteria do. Well, that's not natural selection. That's an intelligent design. What about termites? We had plenty of those in Belize. Termites, and then there's microscopic protozoa. Termites, they eat wood. We dealt with these in Belize all the time. Sometimes you'd have these houses that if you sneezed on them, they'd fall over. They're so eaten up with termites. but it has parasites inside of its stomach, these protozoa, that break down the cellulose structure of the wood. Termites cannot digest the wood, but they live off the nutrients from the wood. How? Because there's this whole separate being inside of it that is breaking these down. These parasites break it down and sharing enough nutrients to keep the termite alive. Neither the termite nor the protozoa can live without the other. So how did that natural selection occur? It didn't. It was an intelligent design. Funny thing to think about is how did Noah keep track of those termites on a wooden boat? I just think about it. There's the acacia tree and the acacia ants, and the ants live in a tree colony. Sometimes number up to 30,000. Tree gives them food, and they ward off herbivores and other bugs that would destroy and kill that tree. The tree and the ants keep each other alive. There's bacteria. Certain fish in very deep water, and I'm going to speed through these for the sake of time. There's certain fish that depends on these luminescent bacteria. They're bacteria. They're not part of the fish. They're bacteria that attach to the fish. They eat off things that are on the fish, and then they are used as like a flashlight, like a headlamp, but like perfectly placed for these fish, luminescent bacteria. And the shrimp and the goby fish, I'm going to move past these. The idea of pollination. Why would natural selection develop special tools on the feet and then the legs of these insects, such as butterflies and bees and whatnot, to pick up pollen and to move it from one plant to another? It doesn't help the insect at all. It doesn't keep the insect alive. The insect's there actually for something totally different than the pollen. What it does is it pollinates and keeps reproducing these plants. It keeps these plant lives alive. That's not part of natural selection. It actually defies natural selection. It's part of an intelligent creation. Moving through there. Nectar. Many orchids produce sweet nectar to attract insects. The nectar itself is complex, being composed of sugar, amino acids, and a whole bunch of ingredients there. And different orchids use different types of odors to attract pollinators. Some even have the odor of rotting meat to attract flies and certain beetles. The stench is said to smell like a herd of dead elephants. Not the type of flowers you want to buy for your mom for her birthday and have on the kitchen counter. But it doesn't do anything for itself. That odor doesn't keep itself alive. It actually attracts these very specific type of insects that are attracted to that for those insects to be kept alive. The color of these orchids, yes, they're beautiful, but they're not for the flower. They're for the pollinators to attract the pollinators to the flower. You see how God made made everything work perfectly together? Then there's mimicry. There's certain orchids that look like a female bee, but they're not. Some of them look like flies to attract pollinators. Then there are traps there for the nectar. I'm pushing through these real quick because there's a couple things I want to get to. Then we're going to get to the idea here of the Earth's ecosystem. So photosynthesis creates and puts off oxygen. We breathe, put off carbon dioxide, which the trees intake, and it goes round and round and round. But in natural selection, what do we care about the tree? How does that benefit us in the survival of the fittest? Plants take in carbon dioxide and produce oxygen. Animals take in and humans take in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. The water cycle as it moves about. Then there's this ecosystem in a forest. I'm moving through. Plants, though they've learned, plants communicate with one another through the air via chemical signals. Do you realize that plants communicate one to another? And they're connected underground via fungi. or fungi, however you pronounce it. These fungi below ground have a symbiotic relationship with plants. They're not part of this plant, or this plant, or this plant. They're connected to all of them, and they all work together. They colonize the roots and act as root extensions. There's communication between the fungi and the plants. There's what they call fairy rings, or evidence of this massive underground network of fungi. The mushrooms are fruiting bodies of the fungi and mark the outer perimeter of a network. That under there, connecting all of that, is a network of fungi, not part of natural selection, part of an intelligent design. Part of intelligent design. Over 90% of plants have a symbiotic relationship with one of these types of fungi. One thimbleful of healthy soil contains several miles of living fungi, fungal filaments. Fungal get carbon from the plants. In turn, the fungal assists the plants in absorbing water nutrients, increasing the absorption by 100 to 1,000 times. So, natural selection says the fungi can absorb all of these nutrients and water. So why would it share it with the tree? Why would it connect to all these other trees? It wouldn't. They sound alarm against invaders. This complex system of a dumb plant life communicates and works together. Darwin didn't know how everything perfectly worked together and was designed at a cellular level. He didn't know how interconnected everything was. His quote-unquote science was based off of ignorance, really. Yet it's still quoted today. Natural selection is quoted like a dogma even today, but in summary, natural selection is the main mechanism of evolution proposed by Darwin. It refers to the survival of the fittest, which is supposed to result in the change of creatures, but leads to evolution. But natural selection can only explain minor variations. Natural selection cannot build, but only select information. And natural selection cannot see the future or work toward a goal, so it would not select something that would not be helpful for the creature in the immediate survival, like wings or a fin on a wolf. And then natural selection requires competition for the survival of the fittest, but nature shows us a symbiotic relationship, not a fighting one. And that is the end of our lesson. We got it all done in one night. Natural selection. See, how can we know it's not true? Well, first of all, we can look around and see it's an intelligent design, not a process of natural selection. Well, there's those four key points. I hope you got those down. Four very clear ways. Any one of those four, you could clearly topple the idea of natural selection. The idea of the Darwin's works of the origin of the species, just ask, what is the origin of said species? Then those four ways that natural selection does not lend itself to proving evolution, it actually does not explain anything at all, really, other than finches still being finches.